Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Are you ready for episode 59? Can you believe it?
Gosh, that is exciting. I really feel things are taking off. The Kitty Kelly seemed to go down very well.
Yeah, we're recording this about a day after Kitty Kelly went out. And it's just about hitting 2,000 views on YouTube, which is pretty good for a day. I was a bit disappointed with Suez. I blame myself for this. I call it Shadows of the Empire. And I reckon a lot of people thought, God, that sounds dull.
Well, maybe not. Well, I think the thing is we have lots of different sorts of listeners, and maybe we have more listeners for certain subjects than other subjects. Doesn't mean we shouldn't deal with serious subjects. And we were keen to have a Canadian spokesman.
Oh, yes. So, I remember it was a fascinating conversation, and I would urge people to take a look or a listen. But sometimes you have to sell. This is my TV background, Andrew. I should have called, like for example, the White Mischief programme, Shadows of the Empire, White Mischief. I should have said drunken aristocrats having sex and shooting each other. I mean, it's the same story, but I bet it would have got a bigger crowd.
Yes, we'll do that in the future. What are we going to call this one then?
Oh, that's a very good question, actually. I don't know. I mean, Agatha Christie kind of sells herself, doesn't she? But
she does, and we've had not enough female subjects and female interviewees, so we've got both this week, and maybe Laura will be as popular as Kitty was.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, Laura is one of our best friends, and we just love her to bits, so I'm looking forward to talking to her. Let's just catch up a little bit, people writing to us and commenting. Another email, Brendan Curry from Fairfax, Virginia. And the good old USA has written to us to say we should look at the Formula One scandal, which is quite interesting,
yep,
isn't it?
Yeah. No, some good ideas coming through. Because we're doing two a week, we're going to go through a lot of material.
We are. And we've also slightly changed it a little bit. We're currently putting them out on Sunday and Wednesday, as opposed to the old way of doing it on Monday. But we reserve the right to change it around again.
We're told that people like to listen on a Sunday night than on a Monday.
Yeah, I think so. Especially, we do have quite a lot of listeners in Australia and New Zealand. And of course, Sunday for us would be it's Sunday morning for them. So they've got all day to listen to it while they're out walking their dogs or whatever people do down there on a Sunday, have barbecues, as I recall. It's pretty popular. It's loads of comments on Kitty, actually. Love to name check people. We did surprise a few people, actually. Jan White, 6038. I was sitting feeling bored, and then a Scandalmongers pops up. Brilliant. Thank you so much. Isn't that nice? Lots of nice comments. Elizabeth Basford saying that we're thought-provoking, intelligent, and it's rare to find quality like this, which is lovely to hear. And a lot of people, Tina Jesse, one of them, Tina Jesse, 859, thought it was very, very funny when you couldn't turn your phone off.
Yes. Well, we've had the roadworks since, so we were warned.
We should have a whip round, maybe do a crowdfunder to get you a decent smartphone.
Yes. That would be lovely.
All right. Now, Agatha, this
Well,
episode.
I mean, you heard Laura come and speak in Putney Library. I've not heard her speak on Agatha. So, what's in store for us?
Yes, my wife runs manages Putney Library in Southwest London, and Laura, who's become a bit of a pal since we've done these interviews, came to talk to a really good crowd. 60 odd people showed up, and she's written the most wonderful biography of Agatha, really perceptive and thoughtful and surprising.
Yeah, I agree.
And the kind of focus, the hinge of Agatha Christie's life is this famous scandal where she, Laura will explain, but she her marriage is falling apart. She has what appears to be a breakdown. She disappears. Nobody knows where she is for, I think, nearly 2 weeks.
She goes to Yorkshire, where people go when these things happen.
Someone was lucky enough to be born there. But yes, she goes to a very posh hotel, which you can still visit in the spa town of Harrogate, which is a rather prim and proper Yorkshire town, quite fancy, quite kind of upmarket. And she basically just lives in this hotel, and people sort of recognize her, but maybe they're too polite to say, "Oh, you, that famous novelist has disappeared."
It's all over the papers at the moment.
Yes. And
But
meanwhile,
being British, they don't.
and the papers are going mad with the story, all sorts of crazy suggestions. She's been murdered, she's been kidnapped, she's disguised herself as a man and is traveling Europe, all this stuff. But she's a different writer and a different person to this experience, and that's why kind of Laura puts it as a sort of pivot point in her life. So that's really good. Should we go and talk to her?
I think we should. Yes,
All right.
I can't wait.
Let's do it. Here we go. Welcome back, Laura. Hello.
Yes, I think no, is she the only one we've had three times?
I think you're the first person to be
You're
on
the
three
first person
times.
to come.
And come
Yes.
on,
Ah,
let's show and tell.
let's celebrate. Let's celebrate.
I'm afraid I haven't got my mug. I've got.
Cool down.
Oh,
Oh,
Andrew.
very smart.
Sorry, very
No,
disloyal.
very,
But
very honored to be your first hat trick, as it were.
yes, exactly. Well, I mean, you write such good books and scandalous books.
Oh,
Well,
we try.
this partly flowed from a wonderful talk Laura gave at Putney Library, which is managed by my dear wife Frances. And I thought, this is great stuff. We must put it on the podcast.
Well, it was great fun to do. It's lovely to meet Frances. And well, I'm always up for talking about Agatha Christie. It's I spent what 3 years of my life or whatever researching and writing that book, but she still absolutely fascinates me. So fire away.
And
Well,
you've done a lot.
let's start at the beginning, because we often rush ahead to the
Yep.
juicy bits, but with Agatha, it's all juicy bits, isn't it? Shall we, a little bit about her early life and how she became initially famous, and then maybe getting into her marriage and before things started to go a bit wrong for her.
Yeah.
And she was truly a global figure, quite young, wasn't she?
Well, I don't know about that really. I mean, she started off not seeing her writing career in terms that we would recognize today. She had no strategy or plans to become what she became. That, in a way, it really took off in a mega way after the Second World War. But she was very successful during the 1930s and made a huge amount of money during the 1930s before tax became, as exigent as it would become. But one of the reasons why the 1926 disappearance, which I know we're going to talk about, one of the reasons why some people have said, oh, it was a publicity stunt, was because it did make her a lot more famous. But I'm 100% sure that was not her intention.
I mean, it was really television and films that really sort of brought her to a global audience, wasn't it? I mean, much later on.
It was really, I mean, what massively made a difference was Witness for the Prosecution, the play, which of course is, I think it's still on now in London, the play in the 50s, and then the film of it, the Billy Wilder film. And also, even something like the 1945 film of And Then There Were None. I mean, she hated, well, she didn't hate Witness, she loved that. But she hated all those films and all that kind of thing, but she was not a screen person at all. But they did, yeah, they made a huge difference. And in a weird way, this immense, completely unforeseen fame that she acquired enabled her to live with the extreme privacy that that she really needed. But in a weird way, she did live hand to mouth because she was always in trouble through absolutely no fault of her own. She was always in trouble with tax bills and was twice advised to go bankrupt, which amazed me almost more than anything I discovered.
That's
And
phenomenal.
it was really her agent, and he was like a gentleman, and he took on this nice lady, and none of it was foreseen. And he
What
was
were
just,
tax rates at that time? I mean, they were in the 1990s, weren't they?
oh,
90%.
I mean, insane. I mean, you don't have to be rabidly right wing to think that they were insane. Yes, I mean, she said she wrote, I remember reading a letter she wrote to her agent, and she said, "You tell me I've earned £30,000. Where is it?" And he said, "I can only tell you, Mr. Butler," i.e. Rab Butler. And it was she got into difficulties in the late 1930s. She made a lot of money from American serialization of her books. She made really good money from. And then there was a test case in America about what tax rates should apply. I won't go into all the boring details, but the test case went on and on. And then there was the war. And so she was being, there was money being held in America that she needed to pay tax rate, huge tax bills over here. And it just became this mire from which she was unable to extricate herself.
Okay. Well, look, I think this podcast on personal finance, we are not. Shall we go back? Can we go back to the 20s? Andrew, stop it. Stop rushing ahead. Can we? I mean, because that's really the what I want to talk about. The
Yes.
first, I said, I got it, obviously got it completely wrong. She wasn't really famous. She was a growing fame, and then
Yes.
suddenly she's on the cover of every newspaper in the world. Tell me about that.
The disappearance.
Yeah, and the years leading up to it.
Yeah, okay. Yes, when she was glad to earn £25 for her first book. That's the difference that we're sort of highlighting here. Well, so she was born on September the 15th, 1890. She was born in Torquay, as I'm sure most people will know. A very, she always portrayed it as a very secure, happy family life. By modern standards, you could probably insert various degrees of trauma into it. Her father died when she was just 11. You could call it a lonely childhood. She had two siblings, a brother, Monty, Madge, her sister, who were 10, 11 years older than her. But that all suited her very, very well. She was incredibly close to her mother, Clara. Incredibly close to her. And her upbringing was a mixture of security because she had her mother, and also freedom because she was on her own, not lonely, and her imagination sort of blossomed. It was a, Torquay was a very regulated, ordered place. And with its social hierarchies and everything, and the Millers, as she was, Agatha Miller, fitted in very well into that. And it was, so it was, you see the sort of as I say, the hierarchies, the order, the structure that underpins her detective fiction, but also this ability to let her mind roam free. And she was always very creative. Initially, she wanted to be a singer. She wanted to be an opera singer. That was her most passionate dream, always, all her life. And she did have a very good voice, but it wasn't strong enough. Music was her great passion. Wagner, all the real big guns. The beautiful piano at her house at Greenway, which is now National Trust in Devon. But it was, And she grew up, you know, they didn't have much money. It wasn't a privileged life in that respect. Her father had, in a gentlemanly fashion, sort of squandered or not taken notice of money. So there wasn't an awful lot of money, but it was, in those days, you could be privileged without money in that way, really. So she grew up, she was a very attractive girl. She had this marvellous blonde hair that she could sort of sit on, tall, very slim, looked very different from her image of her. And very attractive, you know, she had marriage proposals and all this sort of thing. And she fell madly in love with this, frankly, pretty dishy looking bloke, Archie Christie, whom she met at a dance. He didn't have any money either. The mother, Clara, her mother was keen for her not to marry him. She said, I think he could be ruthless. And she was right. But that was the one time in her life, really, that Agatha ignored her mother. And they did marry. They married on Christmas Eve 1914. So, you know, you feel the instant pressure of that date. It was a hurried, they married in a registry office. He was in the Royal Flying Corps, so, you know, liable to be killed at any moment. It was a real Romeo and Juliet job. But he did survive the war. She became a nurse, a VAD. They set up a hospital in Torquay. During the war, she wrote The Mysterious Affair at Styles, which is her first book. She'd already written a novel that nobody knows anything about. I thought it was quite good, actually, not detective fiction. Styles was turned down by, I think it was 5 publishers. Well done, guys. And eventually published in 1920, by which time Archie was back from the war, of course. They had a daughter, Rosalind, Agatha's only child, and they were living in London. And apparently the marriage was, you know, he'd come back from the war, he seemed fine, everything was fine. And they were sort of, as she would have seen it, set fair to have a very happy life together. He encouraged her to write. He wasn't the sort of husband who said, no, you will cook my dinner. Not like that at all. But I suppose the differences between them, and I remember her son-in-law saying to me, you couldn't imagine two people less alike. He knew Agatha very well. He knew Archie. But that was not apparent. It's not apparent when you're young and fancy people, obviously. But after the war, they did start to... They moved to Sunningdale, which is, you know, pure commute about. He worked in the city. He was a passionate golfer and sort of part of the gin and golf set, which was completely not Agatha. And gradually, but things underneath the surface, I suppose, were starting to change between them. But I don't think it would have been apparent, and I don't think things would have come to a head necessarily, because in those days you stayed married.
Mm.
But they didn't, because in 1926, Agatha's mother died in April, which was like so devastating to her. I think her mother was the most important person in her life. He was the love of her life. Her mother died in April. She went down to the family home in Torquay, Ashfield, and did that atrociously painful thing of turning out the things, finding the letters, finding all those signs of love and, you know, childhood memories, etc., etc. He wanted her to come back home. He wanted them to go on holiday together and sort of pull her out of it, because he was quite a brisk sort of man. She said, no, I can't. I'm in grief, too much, you know, grief stricken, blah, blah, blah. Stayed down in Torquay. She always regretted that. Waited for him to come. He came down finally in August of Torquay for Rosalind's 7th birthday party and told her that he was in love with another woman and wanted a divorce. So when people talk about this disappearance, these 11 days in December 1926, when Agatha Christie was missing, as if it's like in a vacuum. But when you look at the build-up, this woman who'd had a reason, you know, a really rather happy, protected life for nearly 36 years, and then this double blow of losing your mother and your husband in the space of 4 months, none of it really surprises me. It all seems to me quite inevitable that you would.
And he told her on the day of her daughter's birthday party.
Well, he didn't. I don't think he told her that day. She'd been down there with the daughter, and nobody would say that Agatha was a particularly maternal woman. They ended up very close, Agatha and her daughter, but she was not a maternal woman. But so she was down at Torquay with her daughter, but the real consolation was her dog. Peter the dog, who she absolutely adored and would cling to at night. He came down. It was clear that something was wrong. And then there's this terrible conversation that she relays in her autobiography, where he says, I've been seeing quite a lot of that girl, you know, Nancy. And she says, well, why shouldn't you? And then he says, you don't understand. So I'm really not surprised that her, I don't know what the technical term for it would be. She had a breakdown, her mental health gave way, whatever. It's not surprising.
But, I mean, they created the story of a lost, you know, amnesia, which wasn't true, but it was to protect the way what happened. Because, I mean, the impression from the book is actually she was reasonably conscious about what she was doing, this period of disappearance.
Yes, it's a difficult one. I mean, there are many differing views on this from the sort of brigade who say she was completely conscious of what she was doing. And she was trying to get Archie, trying to make him feel terrible, she was motivated by vindictiveness, if you like, vengeance. I don't buy that for 1 second. Then you get the absolute opposing camp that say she lost her memory, she did not know what she was doing. I don't buy that either. I think it's somewhere in between the two, whereby she's Agatha Christie. She's a plotter. She set up a plot, if you like. She drove her car to this place, Newlands Corner, which is in Surrey, but it's pretty wild. It's the North Downs, it's vertiginous, it's rather beautiful, but also quite scary. She left her car at the bottom of the slope, overlooking a quarry, like a suicide, really. She left clues inside the car, her driving license, etc. And then she went to this hotel in Harrogate, which everybody knows about, which was where she was found. She drove away from home on the 3rd of December and she was found on the 14th of December.
And she used the name of
in plain sight. Yes, sorry.
Sorry to interrupt, but she also used the name of the girlfriend.
Yes.
Signed in, which was a bit of a clue.
Exactly, yes. She called herself Teresa Neal. The girlfriend was Nancy Neal. But what she did, and I do blame the police here, there was this deputy chief con who was in charge of the thing, Kenwood, who was absolutely fixated on the idea that she was dead, either by her own hand or by Archie Christie's, and was hobnobbing with journalists and, you know, loving it. And the journalists were sort of writing these stories, which, you know, if I were reading them now, I'd think, oh my God, the husband's done it. He's going to be arrested. I mean, it's really reprehensible. And so far from Agatha's intention. But what she'd done on the morning of the 4th of December, so she's in transit, she is in London, from Surrey in London, en route to Harrogate, posted in London on the Saturday was a letter to her brother-in-law, Campbell Christie. And my reading of it, he was the only person who sort of had a foot in both camps, close to Archie and very close to Agatha. She wrote him a letter, which he told the police said, I'm very unhappy, I'm not well, I'm going to a spa in Yorkshire. But he destroyed the letter because presumably it also said a lot of stuff like, and your brother is, you know. Anyway, he destroyed it, but he kept the envelope and the police completely ignored it and said, oh, well, there's no evidence that she posted it. Maybe Archie posted it, or maybe, you know, something like that. So the real clue that she left, the real clue, which I think was meant to make Archie go and find her, because that was what she wanted. She wanted to get him back. She didn't want to do things that would repel him forever, which is what effectively did happen. I think she thought that she could create this thing and it would remain private between the two of them. Because the fact that it became a national scandal, the fact that it became this tabloid sensation like you would not believe. I mean, I spent days reading the newspapers because it was just tons of it.
All saying slightly different things, weren't they?
Yeah. Oh, yes. And very wildly sensationalist. I mean, a bit like Lord Lucan, you know, oh, we've seen her here, we've seen her there. You know, she's disguised as a man. I mean, just crazy. And it just went mega, really, because of this policeman, I think. It was pretty clearly, you know, a marital thing that had gone wrong and she'd taken herself off. But Archie started speaking to the press, which of course is fatal. Then they got onto the fact that there was a girlfriend. And it was, the idea that that was Agatha's intention. You know, in her book, she's very good at the difference between intent. She's very good at cause and effect in her book. And I think if she'd been thinking clearly in her right mind, she would have seen that her intention might not have the effect that it had.
So events overtook them, really. Because you have, I think, a very interesting bit in the book where you say, having, as she thought, helped to destroy her marriage by leaving Archie alone while she grieved for her mother, she had now delivered its death blow by making herself an object of public ridicule and Archie an object of public loathing. And in some ways, that sends him away rather than bringing him to her.
That's my reading of it.
And what was the what was the daughter told? I mean, she must have been terrified.
Oh, no. Yeah. It's well, I said she wasn't the most maternal. They had this marvellous woman, Charlotte Fisher, who ran the show, really. She was Agatha's secretary, but she was more. And the big question, in a way, is how much did Charlotte know? Because there's this thing of the advertisement that was left in the Times, you know, friends of Theresa Neal contact, blah, blah, another sort of clue.
I don't know that. No, do tell us. I'm sure the listeners don't
know.
Well,
I can't make head or tail of it, Phil, if the truth be told. There's an advert, and when you see it in the Times, it's so, you know, it's friends and relatives of Theresa Neal contact box number, whatever, which appeared in the Times on, I don't know, the following week after the disappearance. And I'm assuming that was aimed at Charlotte, but to what end, I don't know, because I met all the people who were still alive. I talked to Agatha's daughter. I talked to Archie's son by Nancy Neal. I talked to Charlotte's niece, and she said, you know, Charlotte was under suspicion. The idea that if she'd really known anything, she wouldn't have told the police is not feasible. And Agatha's daughter was of the view that it was, yes, it was a woman out of her mind making a plan, as it were, to save her marriage. Because I think the last thing she intended to do was disappear for 11 days. But I suppose once you're in it, what do you do?
Well, what was she doing in Harrogate?
She was running around this hotel in Harrogate, having dinner, playing cards. All the front pages were filled with her picture. People saying, you look a little bit like that woman in the papers. And nothing happened. And the person jumped around saying she hasn't signed in under her real name, so she can't be here.
Yes, they did say that. That was, we don't quite know what she was doing in the hotel because, as you know, with things like this, a lot of people come forward afterwards and say, oh, I had dinner with her. I did this. I did that. There's not much that's proved. We do know that she played the piano and signed a piece of music to another guest because that came up for auction. So that we know. And we know that she stayed in the hotel and had dinner in the hotel and occasionally went out and bought, you know, something to wear or something. It's like someone drifting, almost like having a rest from your real life or something. You know, that thing people, some people say she was in a fugue state, which covers a multitude of sins, really. But in a way that I think that is right, because she, you know, her life was so painful. What I think she was just waiting for this to be over, really.
Well, you also have a comment that the 11 days of the creation of an artist, a writer, and writers live life differently. As long
Yes.
as she was creating a slightly subconsciously creating a drama.
Yes, I do think that. I mean, you know, a huge amount of my book is dedicated to this because I just think it's so incredibly interesting. Because you might think about doing something like this, but to do it, I mean, I was so obsessed with it. I actually sort of reenacted it insofar as was possible. I drove from my flats in Richmond to the house, Styles.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
In Sunningdale, and then I drove to Newlands Corner on 3rd of December, I think it was 2005. And it was scary. It was scary. That was how I knew it wasn't a stunt, because nobody would do that unless they were in extremis. You know, it was very unnerving. The idea that she spent hours in that place, because she must have done. She must have been in a terrible, terrible anguish.
You
You
think
just.
she went there? I mean, for example, was it known to be a place where people had killed themselves in the past? Did she
You.
went there with perhaps half a mind to do something like that and then defaulted to something else? Or do you think she always planned the trip to Harrogate?
I think we know she got Harrogate in her mind the next morning because she left a ring at Harrods. It's also Agatha Christie, Harrods, and you know. She left a ring at Harrods and said, to be repaired, please send this to Mrs. Neal at the Harrogate Hydro. So she knew what she was going to do the next morning. The night of the 3rd of December, no, I think she had suicide in her mind. For sure, I do. Because where she drove to was quite near where he, Archie, was spending the weekend with friends, these frightful people who sort of encouraged the relationship with Nancy Neal. Nancy was there. I think she drove, she might even have gone and driven and looked at the house. That's the sort of thing you do when you're in that kind of love hell. She. It's not somewhere you would naturally kill yourself because it's hills, you know, it's vertiginous, but it's not, you wouldn't jump off. But I mean, she wrote these books, which I'm sure you know, these Mary Westmacott books, six of them, which are the opposite of her detective fiction. They're all emotion, they're all unresolved, they're everything put, and I think they're all about Archie, really. And there's one that is directly autobiographical, Unfinished Portrait. I mean, it's the story of losing our mother, it's the story of the marriage. And in that, the woman goes to kill herself. And I think that's true. I think that's.
So she changed her mind, and then went up to Harrogate. And did you go up to Harrogate as well and stay for 11 days?
No, not 11, because I wouldn't have been able to afford 11. But I have been to that hotel quite a few times, yeah, because it's so fascinating. I always think of her coming down those stairs and him being there and thinking, and then it all went horribly wrong. And I just feel real, I do feel real compassion for her.
Because it had a huge impact on the rest of her life, really, didn't it?
Absolutely. It did. And how she rebuilt her life from that is impressive. But I mean, I think the year after was worse, really, because you haven't even got adrenaline or hope or anything. And she didn't have a lot of money. You know, people think she was very privileged. There really wasn't much money. So she had to become a writer. Well, she was a writer, but her career up to that point had been, you know, she'd do a thriller, she'd do short stories, she'd do. It was really Roger Ackroyd, which I always find this weird as well, came out in the middle of all this, you know, came out between her mother dying and Archie saying he wanted to leave her. And in the middle of it, you get Roger Ackroyd, which
And
is.
wasn't the idea put up by Lord Mountbatten? Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, yeah,
Or
well,
is
he
that him
will
taking
die.
credit for something?
I mean, did you find that he had said that? Because I found a letter he'd written to her. Did you? Did
Yes, that's the
he?
same letter. Yeah, he claimed credit, and she was very polite back. But he took a lot of credit for a lot of things he didn't do.
It was, well, his idea was a bit more rococo, wasn't it? It was kind of Poirot was going to be arrested for murder, and the idea was her, according to her, the idea was given to her by her brother-in-law, who she was very close to. And I always thought, oh gosh, you two should have got married, actually. That would have been really good. But of course, things don't work like that. But she was very polite to Mountbatten. He used that because it was his son-in-law who wanted to produce Murder on the Orient Express. That's right, isn't it? And so she allowed that to happen.
Okay. So
But
you say this was the hinge moment of her life and
yes.
it sent her on a new direction. Do you think creatively, in terms of the books that she wrote thereafter, which became more and more successful, they owed something to that trauma that she'd been through?
I do a bit, but of course, when you're writing these books, you're so tempted to read things into things, and that is a fault of mine, and you sort of have to try not to do it too much. I mean, the Westmacott's, for sure, these six books are, well, they're absolute gold to me, they were. And I think a couple of them are really very good. But she would never have written those if she'd, I mean, what would her life have been if she'd stayed with Archie? You know, that is the great counterfactual, really, of her life, I think. What would it have been? It would have been much more restricted. Would it have been happier? I doubt she would have become the figure that we talk about.
Did she remain in love with him? I mean,
I think,
you say he was the great love of her life.
yeah, I think she did really, not to sound overly sort of crass about it. I mean, her daughter, who I really, you know, you feel for in this, she sort of said, well, if I saw him, I couldn't tell my mother because it upset her. You know, she was really torn both ways. And she did say to me, you know, she shouldn't have left him alone. She shouldn't
Because
have left him.
one of the
Yeah.
interesting things I thought in the book was you say that Archie has been slightly sort of demonized, and actually Max Mallowan, her second husband, has been sort of seen as one of the good guys. And actually, what I found so fascinating, he turned out to be a bit of an old goat, possibly having a long affair with the woman he eventually married after her death, which kind of changes our picture a little bit.
So this is we're rushing. You know, people don't know. This is the second husband we're talking about now. So I'm sort of here as to represent the ordinary person. What you're talking about, you two? It's not some
Never.
Oxbridge symposium on Agatha Christie. So let's do it a bit more, maybe systematically. So she does marry again,
Yes,
but
quite quickly.
he sounds like a bit of a shit as well, or not.
I didn't care for him, I have to say, but you can't help these responses you have. But I didn't care for him. No, I thought he was a bit frightful, really. But he made her, he it worked for her. And that, of course, is what mattered. She married him again in 1930. She'd met him because what really saved her was this travel, desire for travel that she had, and finally daring to travel on her own to Baghdad, which of course was not like Baghdad now, but even so, you know, it was quite a daring thing to do. And she went to an archaeological dig, was received with, you know, great admiration as a writer. So it was not this whole Agatha Christie, the woman who disappeared. It was her in a different guise, which must have been restorative. And then she met this much younger man, 14 years younger, Max Marlowe, and he, I mustn't be too censorious, it sort of worked. She had money. He restored her confidence. I always felt he was almost like a replacement for her mother, because she could relax with him, which you can't with people you are wildly attracted to, like she was with Archie. And she could relax with him. He was a good companion. He was jolly. He was fun, which Archie wasn't really. And, you know, people, I met a couple of people who disliked him intensely. But I also met a couple of people who said, you know, he enjoyed life. He had spirit, and he was intellectually stimulating in a way that Archie probably wasn't. All his clever friends at All Souls all thought the world of Agatha. So it was a fantastic life, really, that she would not have had as Mrs. Archie Christie. You know, she travelled. She went to almost every country on Earth.
So many of her most famous books are about that exotic,
exactly.
Orient Express, the Nile, the archaeology here, there, everywhere. And whereas
Absolutely.
Archie was, you know, gin and tonic and the golf club, it sounds like.
Well, he...
And affairs.
Well, only one.
Okay.
Only one. And he... She wrote him a letter when Nancy Neal died quite young. She died in 1958. And Agatha must have written him a letter. I never saw that. But I saw the letter he wrote back to her saying, thank you for giving me those years of happiness with Nancy, which I thought, oh, okay. Because it must have been pretty weird being Archie and Nancy, I feel. It's, you know, living with the shadow of Agatha Christie. It's not like someone you can put out of your minds. But going back to what you said earlier, Phil, I do feel that some of her novels of the 1930s, they do hark a bit, oh, and 40s as well, Five Little Pigs, which I think is her best book. They hark back to something of that triangular dynamic, I think, the wife or the girl who feels herself being supplanted and thinks, if only I could remove that element, life would go back to how it should be. There's an emotional sort of undertow to some of those books, I think, like Sad Cypress, very much so. Even Death on the Nile, Five Little Pigs, massively so. But it's a hint. You know, you don't have to see it if you don't want to, because those books are extremely impersonal, really. Although you get... brilliant flavour of her, but I think the intention is to be impersonal, really.
Because, Jimmy, you say that period was the most productive period of her life, really, and they slightly tailed off later on. I mean, are there books that perhaps readers might not know, less well-known, which you really rate? I mean, you mentioned a few just now.
Yes, that's a wonderful opportunity to... I mean, I think a book like The Hollow, which is just after the war, I mean... It's not an incredibly complicated mystery, but what I love is when she solves the human dynamic is, and you feel the resolution of character, because although some people say, oh, she didn't do people, she couldn't do people, I think that's extremely far from the truth, but almost the opposite of the truth. She doesn't do character in depth. Of course she doesn't. But I do think it's truthful. I do think she's always truthful. I think she's extremely wise, wiser in her books than in life. And something like The Hollow, which is a wonderful human dynamic, I think that is the most marvellous book. Five Little Pigs, I think, does now get more of an airing. Taken at the Flood, written after the war, tremendous sense of that destabilisation in society. You know, she's this kind of, she's a bit of a social historian in her indirect way, I think. I think it's marvellous that we can talk about her this way now, because when I started writing the book, people thought I was insane for taking her seriously, you know. And I don't want to make ridiculous claims and make out she's some sort of... But I do think when she's at her best and the characters and the plot are sort of distilled into one, so the workings of plot are also the workings of character, which is done best in Five Little Pigs, in my view. I don't think anyone else can do that. Nobody else can do that. That simplicity. You know, it would take them twice as many words for a start. And nobody really knows how she did it, because she is actually an instinctive writer.
But she had very detailed notebooks, didn't she? I mean, or rather just the back of envelopes and the back of sort of recipes. But she clearly was plotting the whole time. We kind of imagined that they kind of just came to her.
Yes. And because they're so conceptual, like the ABC murders, you know, I was amazed to see how much she went through to come up with that plot, which feels like just, you know, like that. Oh, and a book like Crooked House, which I also think is a masterpiece, you know, and it starts with the notebook starts with her saying something like, "So who kills whom?" And you sort of think, gosh, did you not know that before you start? You know, it's just the way her mind works, the working towards simplicity, which is, I find extremely admirable, and that she would actually then write them in about 6 weeks. But the Max Merlin, during the war, when he was in North Africa and doing whatever he was doing, who knows? And she knew, you know, there was a 14-year age gap. She knew that there might be, what can one say, incidents. She knew that, but she didn't mind the way she did about Archie. But he would also write her letters saying, "Oh, I've just read Murder at the Vicarage or something. Yes, it's clever. It's almost too clever. And your grammar isn't right," or something like that. You know, and I just think, oh, yeah, you like the money that's come from them. I shouldn't say this, because it as a construct, the marriage worked. And she, as I was saying earlier, she sort of lived in an odd way, hand to mouth, because so much money that she earned then went in tax. But she still lived in a very grand style. She had Greenway in Devon, which anyone who's visited will know is the most beautiful place. I mean, it's just sublime. And she had a house in London, and of course this travel that she did, all, you know, this wonderful travel. And then when Max was running his own dig, bankrolled by Agatha, but nevertheless, she enjoyed it. She enjoyed dig life. And I think it was a respite for her, particularly as her fame grew. She could just go there and be Mrs. Mallowan and clean the ivories with her Pond's face cream and write undisturbed.
I mean, what struck me reading the book is very much the experience I had writing about John Buchan 30 years ago. Everyone underrated them as a writer. They were accused of racism and anti-Semitism. And you deal with these questions, I think, very well, showing that she was, as you say, a much more complex writer and actually a less prejudiced writer than people realise.
Well, thank you, because that is you will know, that's an issue one comes up against. This ridiculous contemporary desire to judge people according to the prejudices of today rather than 50, 100 years ago or whatever. I mean, it's one can only hope people get over it. But there are occasional moments in her books when you just think, I would just take that word out. And I think they have now. But how you can call someone a racist who lived about half the year in the Near East, it just doesn't make sense to me. She was a
Well, we spoke about this actually
cosmopolitan.
in Putney. Outside Britain, she's often known as the anti-British writer. People liked her books because she punctured the sort of pompous idea of the respectable British bossing half the world and quietly committing all these horrible crimes, and which always came back to haunt them in the end. So she was seen as being quite progressive, I think,
That's so
certainly in
interesting.
France.
Yeah, I remember you saying that's so interesting, isn't it?
That's how she was marketed. The people who didn't like the British would love this book.
That's so funny because our received image of her is such a cliche. I mean, I think it's been dispelled now through the 21st century. I hope it has. Not. Although in a weird way, these modern adaptations, they sort of undercut her in a way because they use her stories, they use her plots, which are so marvelous and indestructibly compelling, in order to undercut what she allegedly stands for. So maybe you should tell these modern adapters how she was viewed in her time, because I think that would surprise a lot of people.
Well, there are. I can think of
Who brings
several
it?
plots that were certainly sins of the empire, things that had been done out in the far-flung world of pine trees and palm trees come back to haunt people. There's lots of that.
There absolutely is. I mean,
A lot of people look a bit like her husband, get their comeuppance.
but also, it's a bit like any good writer, they can be reinterpreted for every generation. And clearly, with these new films every Christmas, which have brought a whole new readership, we're getting a slightly different take. And as you said, the irony is they feel they're being rather clever, and all they're doing is actually falling into
Yes.
what she perhaps was even hinting at.
Yes, I
We
do.
should
But, I
push
mean,
Laura's book. If you want to understand Agatha Christie by Laura's wonderful book, which will be
yes, I agree.
linked to this podcast.
It
That's
is, I
great.
think it is the definitive book. I mean, people have written other books since, but they haven't really added anything to the story. And I mean, you've done the hard work, the research, and it seems, having read the other books, that there isn't really much that they add to the story since yours.
Well, honestly, that means a lot, Andrew, because I did, well, I was very lucky. I was given access to everything. Her family were pretty marvelous to me, there's no doubt about it, and they didn't take anything out or make any demands. I was very, very, very lucky. So I don't know that there is much more, to be perfectly honest, but as you say, there is reinterpretation, although I will never buy the idea that she was a feminist. I mean, she was in how she lived. She was not in how she thought. You can't put these contemporary things onto people. She was enraged when someone said, "Are you like Miss Markle?" She said, "No, I'm not. She's a spinster. I've been married twice." She didn't see life in those ways. Her books are supremely anti-ideological in every respect. Even books that nobody reads, like Destination Unknown, which I kind of love, it's a plea really for moderation, for healthy skepticism, for disbelief in ideology. Everyone should go and read it now, I think.
Gosh, well, amen to that. Very, very good point.
Well, I think and it led some people to think she was naive or, didn't couldn't see lacking in sophistication. Well, that's the last thing she was, and she never worried about shocking her. I remember P.D. James saying to me, "Oh, she'll kill children. Most of us are very nervous of that." She was very like Miss Marple in that respect. She was unshockable and,
I mean, the mousetrap, I know we're not supposed to talk about the mousetrap, even though it's all these years old, but it's a horrible story of abuse.
It
I mean,
is.
and cruelty. And she had a very dark side to her.
Yeah. Well,
She
frankly,
was not
Patricia
ashamed to kill.
Highsmith,
Sorry?
same sort of thing. Patricia Highsmith, just to reassess now, same, I mean, not, again, sort of misunderstood perhaps in her time and now appreciated.
Yes, that's interesting. But because Agatha always does it this incredibly simple style, which, you know, I was reading when I was nine or whatever with absolute ease. You know, again, that has led people far less now to think to mistake simple for simplistic. And actually, as we know, to write simply is a damn sight harder than to fill it all out, flesh it all out. You know, you read a book like Towards Zero, the solution of which is as dark as anything ever written by Highsmith or Ruth Rendell or any of that. But you don't have to read it that way. It just sort of rattles around in your mind after. She's an extraordinary writer, really, because it's so impressionistic and it only ever gives you what you need. And I can only think of that as just a very happy instinct. I mean, she wasn't really educated in any formal way or anything. I sometimes wonder if that goes with if, you know, our English degrees sometimes knock some of that out of us. I don't know.
Well, look, I think we probably wrap this up because we had nearly an hour.
Oh
It's
no,
absolutely
have we really?
fascinating.
Oh my God.
We could go
Okay.
on for longer, or
No,
I could go on.
we need you to be a literary critic.
Oh well, I mean,
Read the
good company.
book. Read the book is
Yeah,
the
I'd say
answer.
that to anybody watching or listening. Do read this book if you've got any interest in Agatha Christie. It is so well written, and like all of Laura's works, full of humanity and insight.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank
And
you so much.
thank you for being our first hat trick.
No more mugs, though, I'm afraid. You only get one.
Yes.
Oh,
No,
no, that's one
get
more.
send her. Well, you may get a T-shirt if you're very lucky.
Oh,
my God. Are you serious? You're doing T-shirt? This is a whole merchandising thing.
Yes,
Wait,
it is.
yes.
Yes, we're
Okay. Where
challenging
do we
the
get
Sarah
the
Duchess of York here.
sportswear, you know?
I'll wait for the baseball cap.
Thanks a
All the best. Thanks so much.
lot. Bye.
Lovely to
Bye.
see you both. Bye-bye.
Well, a real bumper edition. Good. I mean, could have gone on longer. Fascinating, what she had to say.
Yeah,
And
I do love the way she thinks and talks.
yeah, and I mean, really, really good writer. So, I hope that will lead people to both her book and Agatha Christie's books.
Yeah, I guess
But
it's timeless. I mean, it's funny, as Laura was saying, she is kind of the social conventions of her time. You know, she's not a modern person in that sense. She's kind of very much of her period. And yet, she does things we would regard as very modern, very dark themes. Betrayal, abuse, hypocrisy. I mean, that's just part of the human condition. I mean, you know, Shakespeare would have recognized some of those characteristics. She's
yeah,
timeless.
well, I think each generation, comes to her afresh and sees fresh things in her. But I agree, and I think she makes the point very early on in the book, with the new introduction, that she is a very contemporary figure in many ways, and that's why the modern dramatists really can see something there they can play with.
Yeah, I quite like these modern versions, actually. I'm not sure Laura does. I quite like them. And I think it does help her reach a bigger, younger audience. Maybe we should
Yeah.
abandon this scandalous stuff and just do a literary criticism show. What do you think?
Yes, well, I'd be happy. I'll have John Buchan in next week. See what other people think. Well, Scandalmongers does cover a variety of crimes. We were criticised for using it as a title, I think, to start with. It's seen as a bit downmarket, but it does cover a wide range of subjects. I still feel our championing of investigative journalism is still a very should be a very strong thread.
No, I agree. Actually, that's a good excuse to talk about next week because we're having another
Yes.
themed week, aren't we, coming up? Do you want to tell people
Yes.
what's going on?
Well, I'm very excited because it's my subject, spies. We've got Robert Verkerk talking about the Gareth Williams case, which he was going to write a book about. This is a man, an MI6 agent, GCHQ employee, who was found dead in a bag. And the great mystery is how he got inside this bag and why he died. And then on the Wednesday, we are looking at the John Vassall case. The author, Alex Grant, who's just written a very good book on him, talks about Vassall actually being much more of a victim than perhaps a spy. And so two slightly different takes on modern spying.
And they both have a sort of sexual element to them as well. Vassal blackmailed really for being gay at a time when that was still illegal, and people had to live very secretive lives. Our friend Jonathan Brewer wrote, sent us some press cuttings from the early 60s about the case. It's astonishing. I mean, this is our lifetime, Andrew. A front page of a national newspaper. How to spot a homo. I mean,
yes, well, Alex talks about that in the book. Yes, they like talking to old ladies or something and eating and drinking tea.
Yes, if they're flamboyantly dressed and they're close to their mothers, it's a sign they might be homosexual. So
right.
Social history as well as a great spy story. So that's that. And then, yes, the Gareth Williams, I mean, they sort of, I don't know whether they were trying to smear him, but there's a suggestion of he was into S&M, bondage. You know, maybe he put himself in the bag as part of some bizarre autoerotic thing.
Yeah, and like dressing up as a woman as well, they throw in.
Yeah, I mean, all human life is here.
Yeah, but was it the Russian mafia? Was it a game that went wrong? And why were MI6 so unhelpful when this police investigated it?
Yeah, that one.
So I think that's going to be a really good week.
Yeah, it looks really dodgy, isn't it? Yeah, we've got lots going
lined up.
Yes, we have. We have lots lined up. More scandals. We've got some sport. Would you believe snooker? A scandal in the world of snooker coming soon?
Snooker and Sheffield. I mean, that must be a first.
Yeah, well, Harrogate, Sheffield. We're covering all the main Yorkshire bases.
And then Martin Rosenbaum talking about FOI, Freedom of Information. Yes. He's a great expert. And so we're looking how we pair them. Do people like themed programs, or are they happy just with individual programs twice a week? So yeah. Do tell us what you think.
We're still young, we're still experimenting, we're still growing, and we're still grateful. So if you've enjoyed this show, please like it. If you haven't yet, please subscribe on YouTube. Yeah. That makes a big difference to us. And thanks
do
for
contact
listening.
Us because there's a mug in it.
Yes, do contact us, and we're going to give a monthly mug for the best comments. We're already given one. All right, thanks everybody.
Great, see you on Sunday.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.